inch by inch, row by row. Gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch, row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sowed. Someone warmed them from below till the rains come tumbling.
Welcome to The Manic Gardener, where every week we deal with some aspect of organic and sustainable gardening or some ecological or political issue that bears on them. This week we are talking about thrifty gardening. I'm Kate Gardner. Be sure to check out the parallel post in the blog at themanicgardener.com. Now, there probably are some people for whom money is no object, but I have to say I don't know any of them, and it certainly is an object for me. Too often, one I can't grasp. It seems so large. So spending money on the garden often just leads to a profound sense of guilt. And if I knew I were doing it wisely and well, I'd feel a whole lot better, which is why Marjorie Harris's book, Thrifty Gardening from the Ground Up, is such a relief to me and so welcome. It's my new guide to gardening sanity, and it makes me feel much better about the miniature clippers or secateurs that I have recently purchased, because they're just so good, even though they were pricey. It's embarrassing, actually, that a year ago I had not heard of Marjorie Harris, and it's a testament to the fact that I, you know, how well I have protected myself from the world of gardening books until I took up podcasting, I may say, because Marjorie has written some 17 books, 15 or 16. How many is it, Marjorie, about gardening?
15 about gardening, including one encyclopedic book called Flora North America.
All right.
I've spent the last, I don't know, since 1989 doing nothing except writing and gardening.
And gardening.
So I'm very lucky.
Yeah, and gardening. Let's not leave that part out.
I don't ever write about stuff I don't do.
Good. Well, I'm fascinated that one of your books was Better House and Planet, Ecological Household Hints, another Ecological Gardening. Besides books, of course, Marjorie has the requisite blog, A Life in the Garden, and she writes the gardening advice column for Toronto's paper, The Globe and Mail. So it's actually particularly odd that I didn't know you a year ago, because almost as soon as you and I touched base, it felt as though we had known each other for a while. And
That's true. I mean, isn't that not a sort of an aspect of gardeners that you just adore?
Yes.
Is that we do have this connection with each other.
Yes.
Whether we're in the same country, which we aren't, and whether we know our backgrounds, which we don't.
Right. Yeah. Although in our case, we, of course, had the knees to draw us together as well.
Yes, we did bond over our knees.
Yes. Because when I first asked Marjorie to come on to the show as a guest, she said no, she couldn't. She was proofing the galleys for her latest book, this book, and she had just had knee replacement surgery. And I said, knee replacement surgery? Why, I had both my knees replaced, 2 years before at that point? And of course, you know.
Well, you gave me very good advice, most of which I paid attention to.
Oh my gosh. Well, that's scary. If anything goes wrong, it'll be my fault.
Oh, absolutely.
But I'm glad. Oh, thanks. I'm glad you found it helpful. At any rate, it was a profound bond, and eventually the galleys were indeed done. The book came out. She sent me a copy, and here we are today talking about thrifty gardening from the ground up. Now, when Marjorie first offered to send me this book, I was just slightly nervous, because I am a very intense and demanding reader, and there's nothing worse than being offered a manuscript, much less a book, that then you don't like. Well, I need not have feared, because Marjorie is a wonderful writer. I hope you.
Oh, thank you.
Well, it's true. Everything I've seen of yours now, I feel that way about. And this one is not only extremely useful, full of just great information, but it's funny. It's wonderfully readable. Have you got a copy handy?
I do.
Good. Well, would you do us the favor of reading us the third paragraph of the introduction? It's on page 2.
All right, I will.
Thank you.
There is something about making a garden that goes way beyond the intense pleasure of the act itself. And when you start to get compliments, you are doomed. You long to become more accomplished, to discover better ways of growing plants, or make your surroundings even more delicious. Then, the minute you realize you couldn't care less if anyone likes what you are doing, and that you do it for yourself alone, a seismic shift takes place. You've become a crazed gardener, and for that, there is no cure.
A crazed gardener.
It's true. It's true.
Well, you have noticed the name of the show and the blog, The Manic Gardener.
Yes, crazed, manic.
Exactly, yes.
Pretty much the same sort of thing.
So I thought, okay. Well, I'm doomed.
But, you know, it's the one, I want to explain one reason why I wrote this book, because I also have a garden design business, and garden design is too fancy a word for what I do. I design with plants. I'm a planter. I'm a garden planter business. But it's, and I don't do, you know, a lot of hardscaping and stuff like that. I like doing everything with plants.
Mm.
And my experience has been that people are so intensely plant and garden blind, it's enough to make you weep. And I thought, well, if there is one way to get to most people, it's through their pocketbooks. And if I could convince people that gardening could be thrifty, because it can be very expensive as well.
Indeed.
And that maybe I would get a few more converts to what we think of as an essential part of our lives. And it's always staggering to me that it is an essential part to everybody's life.
Yeah. Well, how then do you make this, how do you convince people as prospective clients that it's worth their time hiring you instead of just going to the garden store and buying a bunch of stuff?
Because if people are going to hire somebody like me, it's because they are so desperate. They cannot figure out what to do. They've got a mess. I mean, you can't believe the gardens I go into. They are unbelievably ugly. If your listeners sign up to my blog, I will send them
photos.
I'll send them a newsletter in which I've got befores and afters of some of the disgusting gardens I've gone into, and I find the challenge. I love it for one thing, and the other thing is you change people's lives when you fix their gardens, and it. For instance, we were in a garden the other day, which was quite nice. It had been pleasant, but the people were just, it just made them unhappy. They had a nice house. They were art collectors. When we started working, he said, you know, this is like a work of art. You just stand here and you know it's right. And they email me every day saying it's perfect.
Wow.
You know, that, I mean, I live for that, but it changed their lives. They're going to spend a lot more time in their garden. They're going to be a lot happier in the city that they're living in and in the part of the city they're living in. And to me, that becomes something fairly thrifty, because instead of wasting your time going out for expensive dinners, you're sitting in your nice garden enjoying and smelling the plants.
And if you can do it primarily with plants rather than hardscaping,
yeah,
that's going to save money.
Well, it does, and there are a couple of principles I work on, and that this goes for any kind of gardening whatsoever, but especially thrifty gardening, is that do not buy a plant until you have prepared the soil absolutely thoroughly, till you've dug it down if it's crappy. You have to dig down to see if it's all junk under there anyhow, and if it is, fix it.
Hang on.
If it's not good, add compost.
Okay.
If you have to wait a year.
Wait, whoa.
Wait.
Okay. I think we're getting a little ahead of ourselves here. We'll get to the plants, but first, I just realized we'd better define hardscaping.
Oh, yes. Hardscaping is all those lovely raised beds, the pergola, the waterfall, the, you know, it's anything that isn't plants.
The wall, the terracing, bringing
absolutely
in boulders.
And the softscaping is the plants,
yeah.
And that's what I'm interested
right.
in.
Right. Well,
how do plants fit in with your neighborhood? How do they fit in with each other, and how can you make an ecologically sound garden? I mean, this is extremely important to me.
Right. Well, let's pause on that one for 1 second, because you do garden only organically yourself, correct?
Absolutely. I do not ever. In fact, I've been living in the same house since 1967, obviously same garden. There has never been one chemical in here, never ever needed one either. And it's because, I mean, even before I knew what it was, I believed in biodiversity. I did not.
Then you
like
were way ahead of the curve.
Oh, God, you're not kidding. The first edition of Ecological Gardening came out before. The first question everybody would say is, what's this ecological stuff?
Oh, my goodness. When
you
was
know, they
this?
Had no concept of what ecology was, or that you created systems, or that this was a closed system.
When was that, Marjorie, that first came out?
It was in the 90s.
And nobody knew what that was then?
Not really. Oh, not really. I mean, certainly not the kind of people who were interviewing me on radio and TV, because they had... The sort of whole ecological movement hadn't started, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the book was definitely ahead of its time. It was also interesting, I found. I did a second edition of the book rather more recently, and I had changed my mind about many things because we had a lot more information.
Indeed.
For instance, in those days, Roundup seemed like a pretty good idea because it didn't stay in the soil. Well, what we've discovered since then is it can be in the soil for 50 years. It has a long, long half-life.
It has had some hard knocks recently.
Very much so. So, I mean, that would be one major thing in which I changed my mind.
Now,
and other things like, you know, simpler things, simpler ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm. That's always
nice. Which are
available
to us now. Now, well, it is, and it's totally unnecessary to do, you know, a lot of complex things with chemicals. I'm a default organic gardener because I didn't understand what all that stuff was on the labels.
Could you explain closed system, and then I want to get to the thriftiness, but you mentioned that term.
Well, the Earth is a closed system. Everything that is within Gaia, is within this closed system, is affected by something else. And if something really goes wrong, like the nuclear accident, the tsunami, you know, we're all paying for it all around the world.
We can't get rid of the effects of our actions.
We can't get rid of it.
Yeah.
I mean, when they had nuclear meltdowns in Russia, I mean, they were eating the stuff within 3 or 4 months in Finland. I mean, we didn't understand all of that and how everything is affected by everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So that every move we make has a consequence. And the same thing happens with our gardens. I mean, when I think of a closed system, I'm thinking of, you know, my city, my neighborhood, my street kind of thing. And if we've got one person spraying chemicals all over the joint, they float in the air, they're going to be hitting whatever is around me, affecting my grandchildren. And we can't allow that to happen.
Yeah, it matters so what we do in our gardens.
It matters hugely. And the more we garden and the more we understand how plants operate, for instance, if you're observant in the garden, you can see all sorts of insects and butterflies and moths and stuff come in and watch them at work in your garden and see how valuable they are.
So this underlies everything that you do. And I just wanted that to be clear before we launch on the seemingly other topic. And we'll move to that one now. And one of the things that's fascinating here and that I did not expect when I picked up the book was that, I mean, I thought there'd be all kinds of things about arranging plants and choosing plants, obviously, but you start with buying a house.
Yes, I do. Because one of the things that young people keep forgetting is that they're going to have a garden around the house.
Ah, yes.
And,
if they're
and
lucky.
They will spend every penny they've got renovating a house and then forget that they've got to fix the garden.
Why?
I mean, without
what if
a
they
good
don't
garden
care?
Around a house, it's depressing. And most people get depressed on renovations anyway. So I wanted to start with, if you were going out and buying a house, what would you look for?
Indeed.
And I recommend some tools that people take with them.
Like?
Well, a carpenter's level, for one thing.
Why? Why to the garden?
Well, if you were going to buy a condo, for instance, most of them are put up, like, they're just absolute crap. I would absolutely use a carpenter's measure to see if the balcony or terrace is draining into the living room or away from the living room.
Are there actually balconies that drain into the living room? And I mean,
oh, I have heard horror stories of people who have gotten in touch and said, I don't understand it. My living room is damp. And I said, no, well, is your terrace draining into the living room? These things aren't necessary. You can't count on it.
All right.
If you saw water sitting around in the garden, what would occur to you? I mean, to me, I would think, whoa, is that ever? There's very high groundwater. There's a leaky pipe.
And or this,
you know,
soil,
something's wrong here.
The soil is impervious. It's not draining.
I mean, so you want to be prepared to look at your environment as well as your nest is essentially what I'm saying here. Mm-hmm. And to be forewarned is to be armed.
Are there other
very
tools
well.
One should carry with one aside from the level?
Well, I would always carry a trowel with me anyway, but I usually have either a trowel or secateurs or both in my handbag at all times.
Okay.
But a trowel, just, I mean, for instance, if you are buying a house and you are interested in gardening, just move the soil around a bit and see what's under there.
What am I looking for?
Because if it's a new house, it's more than likely they've just taken away all of the topsoil and left you with nothing much except, you know, some sod there, and it's not going to last.
Yeah, frequently now when a development goes in, the topsoil is actually removed and sold separately.
Oh, yes, sold separately, probably back to you.
And then the sod is just laid down on top.
Yep.
And there you go.
I mean, I thought maybe this was an old problem, but I bet I get at least once or twice a week people sending me emails saying, why? And I'll say,
why will nothing grow?
Look, why nothing grows, why the sod looks terrible, you know, it's only been in here for a year, what's wrong, what are we doing wrong? And the answer is, you have done nothing wrong. Yeah, exactly.
So what?
It's very upsetting.
How do you know what you're looking for? If you're not already a gardener and you lift a corner of sod or whatever, how can you tell whether what's underneath is topsoil or not?
It's not going to look beautiful and dark and friable. It's not going to feel nice in your hand. It's going to be full of stones and too much sand. It's going to have construction junk in there.
Or very clayey in a different part of the continent. Instead of sandy, you might get just heavy clay.
Really, really heavy clay.
Yeah. And how can I tell if it's heavy clay by feeling it?
Well, if you put your hand in it, if you've just scrunched your hand up, it would keep the same shape. Mm. You can make ashtrays out of the thing if you still smoke.
You're talking about my soil here. Okay.
I have very heavy clay too, and I wouldn't have known what heavy clay was. But when we bought our house, if I had had a clue, mm-hmm. I would have been very, very wary of buying this house because right next door, there was a weeping willow growing. I had no idea.
Hold on to that one for one sec. The friable soil one's actually looking for means that it has a nice...
It's dark, it's crumbly.
Crumbly,
it
but doesn't just
nice.
Fall apart in your hand the way a handful of sand would. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Bob,
and I mean, if you found a place like that, buy it immediately.
No matter what the house is like.
Yeah, well, fooey on the house. A house you can fix. Soil takes longer.
Yeah. What's wrong with having a weeping willow next door?
Well, it indicated a lot of things. One, in our case, that there were underground streams and that the weeping willow was going to get to be maybe 80 feet tall in only a few years, and maybe it was going to stretch across five gardens.
Mm.
It's terrible, terrible plant for the city and dangerous, very dangerous.
Because?
In this case, the after only, I don't know, 20-odd years, a limb fell out of the tree that was so huge it almost killed their children. Mm. I mean, it's a scary, scary plant. It's great if you're out in the country and your pond is way down there. Put in a weeping willow. You'll love it.
Yeah.
Not in a town or a city.
The weeping willow indicates that there's a lot of water.
A lot of water.
And
a lot of water. And what I didn't realize was that we're on a floodplain, and that my garden was going to flood every year. Oh. And I was going to be working with that little problem for the rest of my life.
Now, how's that? You're in Toronto. There are not, I mean, and most of the streams and rivers are down in fairly deep ravines. So
no, they're not. You see, this is what, we're built on alluvial soil here, and it's all little, there's something called Tattle Creek that dissects this particular neighborhood, and there are little off streams, and one of these little off streams runs through my house.
Through your house?
Through the house.
What does that mean?
Again, something we didn't know when we bought it.
Well, if it's
there was a lot of damp down in the basement.
Runs under your house?
Through the house, actually.
I don't
understand. We ended up having to.
How can you have a stream through your house?
Well, it washed around it. It kept it very, very dampy and mildewy for many, many years. And when I dug down, had the basement dug down further so I could put a room down there, the stream just gushed through. And I said, can we make a water feature out of it?
Oh my gosh.
And they said, yeah, it'd be a waterfall.
Oh my gosh.
So we had to do, oh God, it was so elaborate, the number of things that we had to do. And yet my neighbors on either side don't have this problem.
It's just you. Because you're in the path of this miniature stream.
Because I'm in the path of this stream.
That is not evident. There isn't a stream bed with a flow of water.
No, except for that I should have been tipped off by the spring, the rising of the water. It just, it's miraculous in a way. Because it was a pond and the water just, when there's lots of snow and there's snow melt and everything, it just all rises and it all comes into my garden.
Oh, lovely.
Because it's the lowest garden in the whole neighborhood. Mm. Everybody drains into me.
So also watch out for the lowest piece of land on the block.
Absolutely. So if you notice that the garden is 8 inches lower than anybody else's, be prepared to dig dry wells.
Okay. So watch out for the weeping willow, for the absence of topsoil, for the lowest land on the block. What else should somebody look for in the garden when buying a house?
Well, you see, I wouldn't worry about if the garden was beautiful or anything like that, that there was a lot of lovely old plants. I mean, that's always nice. You're gonna use whatever is there. But I wouldn't worry about that sort of thing. If the garden isn't gorgeous, you know, there's always this stuff about real estate agents say that a lovely garden can add 20% to the value of your house. Well, so what?
If you're selling it, you might care. But
yeah, I mean, when you're selling it, you say, oh, yes, indeed. But if you're looking for a house, you don't necessarily need to have a beautiful garden because you are going to make a beautiful garden if you've got good soil.
Yeah.
So the first, that's be the most important thing to look at is there good soil here? Am I going to have to spend thousands of dollars, you know, replacing the soil because it's so awful?
Is that what you're looking at? Thousands of dollars if the soil is bad?
Oh, well, you know, in a city the size of Toronto, yeah, it costs quite a lot of money.
Well, what do you do? Okay, suppose it sounds like you're doomed because if the garden, you know, if most subdivisions now have the topsoil removed, and what are you going to do?
The thing is that if you know that this is what's going on, then you've got to either talk to the developer and say, I'm interested in this house, but I'm not interested in the soil. Can you please bring me back some of my topsoil?
Mm.
Or you're going to be prepared mentally that you're going to have to add lots and lots and lots of organic matter like compost or manure to the soil to bring it up to snuff,
mm-hmm.
so that you can plant trees and shrubs and all sorts. And it's a kind of a mental balance that you want to have where if you're buying a new house, or you're buying an old house but new to you, is what you are prepared to do. And I would advise almost everyone to save, put aside a percentage of their renovation money to put into the garden around them. I mean, you can make a big difference in a very, very simple way.
Like? So let's onwards now to renovation. You've bought the house, and I gather
I bought the house. It's not got great stuff around it, but I would say 20 feet out from the central axis of the house, dig an area, refresh the soil, make it really, really lovely, and plant a gorgeous tree. A perfectly placed tree can just lift your mood. It can do almost anything for you. And make sure it's a native tree. Like if I were living in the middle of the desert, I would make sure that it was some kind of a desert plant that was imposing, that caught my eye. I would, if I lived in a mountainous region, I'd have something, a low pine. If you find something that is native to your region, you cannot make a mistake. The first thing I planted in this garden, it was absolutely going on taste. It had nothing to do with knowledge. Is I put in a service berry, Ameling here, canadensis. And I had no idea, A, that it was a native plant, B, that it would produce berries.
Wait, were you
C,
lucky?
That it would have I was so lucky. But I thought, what a beautiful plant.
Mm-hmm.
Put it in 1968. And it is still with me and still doing a great job.
Beautiful blossoms, white blossoms in the spring.
Yeah.
Edible berries for birds or for jam in the autumn. Lovely red leaves in the fall.
Yep, and then lovely striated gray bark. I like walking in my garden in the wintertime, so I like to really look at the bark in winter.
Mm.
And so I tended to concentrate on buying trees and shrubs that have exfoliating bark because the birds adore it for nest building. And it's something really, really pretty to look at all times of the year.
Interesting. Yeah, you were lucky with that service berry. Yeah, one of the things that strikes me about planting a native tree is that it's probably going to do better in that denuded soil than something fancy and alien would.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, I mean, we're seeing the folly of planting aliens in the city I live in because some politician many, 80 or 90 years ago said we must have Norway maples. And so we have all these dead and dying Norway maples that have, you know, pushed out our own native, beautiful maples that we have that are native to this area.
Exactly. There are plenty there. And don't Norway maples have a nasty habit of not letting anything grow under them? Is that the Norways?
God, they're just awful. Just awful. Yeah. And it's not like having a black walnut. That can be pretty bad. But I live underneath a silver maple, which is marginally better because I can grow things underneath it. And it's wonderful habitat for birds and stuff like that. And unfortunately, as I see right now, a lot of squirrels.
Why is that unfortunate?
Well, because squirrels are the squirrels are the bane of most gardeners' lives. they dig up our bulbs. They eat the top off the tulips. I mean, they are just a pain in the neck.
I have squirrels in my yard, but I have many pines and spruce, and so they're just happy with the cones. It's merely a matter when we got them out. But we managed to stop them from hiding the cones in the attic. We conceded the garage. Because it took 3 years to get them out of the house.
Woo.
Yeah.
Well, you understand what it's like to be besieged by nature. I mean, we're very lucky in the neighborhood I live in because I'm right downtown, and we have a red-tailed hawk that hunts here every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's gotten rid of the family has gotten rid of our skunks. we had skunks breeding 10 babies at a time. We don't have those anymore. We don't have pigeons.
Do you know that the hawk is
watching nature working together this way?
Yes. Do you know the hawk is responsible for removing your skunks?
Oh, absolutely. Because we were overrun with skunks and stuff before the hawk came to live in our neighborhood.
Then you want to keep the hawk, which means plant natives, people.
Very much so.
Yes. Well, okay, you've bought your property. You've saved, put aside some money for renovating. You've planted your one beautiful tree. Now, you say you might be looking at thousands of dollars in terms of putting in soil. Suppose if you've already got sod there, all right, do you have to have the sod removed, put the soil down? Do you stick the just throw the soil on top of the sod? What do you do?
What I would do, and what you see, I'm not a huge grass fan. I think that some grass is nice in some gardens, but I wouldn't want to be surrounded by grass. So I would, of course, create a berm with the grass. I'd take it all off, turn it upside down, and contour the landscape with the grass, and then put some compost on top of it and let it compost down and then plant it. And in the rest of the garden where the sod has been removed, I would start digging. I would be making new beds everywhere.
And that
I would make my life hell.
That pile of sod is your one concession to hardscaping then. You make a mound somewhere.
I make a mound out of it.
Right. Okay.
That's soft hardscaping.
Well, what about designing this garden once we're into that area? Do it yourself?
I think you should really try to do it yourself, because I think most people have an idea in mind, and that if you have no ideas, if you haven't done any research, it's useless to you and to a designer. Because, I mean, the hellish client is one who thinks they know something, don't know, but is pretty sure they're right anyway.
Sounds like you're saying do it yourself because I don't want you for a customer.
precisely. But I mean, at least make an effort. Do some research. Figure out, if you don't have a vision of what you want in the future, of how you need your garden to operate right now. Like if you've got two kids and two dogs, you have a completely different way of living from somebody who is in their 50s, kids have left home, and they have a cat. I mean, you've got to know how you need to have the garden work for you, and you have to know what you need from the garden. In our garden, we had four kids, so I made sure that there was a space for me. I called it my moon-gazing platform. And I used it for many years just to escape from the bloody kids, just to get away from them out in the backyard and sit and read. And then I slowly added plants around me, including the serviceberry.
So
but
one of the things you've
got to have something like that for yourself. You could call it your secret garden. Mm-hmm. You've got to have a place for kids to play, and you've got to make concessions to dogs.
So shape the garden to your life and your needs.
To your life.
And the first
yes.
thing then would be to go out there and think, or just think, what do I need from my outside
yeah.
space? And then go look at it and think, okay, if I need a space that's all mine, where would I put it?
Yes.
And
grab the best space for yourself.
Whether you're doing it yourself,
not the kids,
or hiring somebody. You would want.
Now,
you would then
you're
have
going
something
to hire,
resembling
yeah,
a plan.
If you do feel that you don't, you're just not far enough along, and you, it's the best money you can spend if you get the right person, if you've got the right chemistry, if you can learn a lot from each other. Because most designers, who, if they're any good, are going to end up saving you money, because you're not going to be making dumb errors like putting the wrong tree in or putting something on the top of a hill that should be in the bottom of a valley, that sort of thing. Because if you get a pro, they're going to know the difference between one and the other.
And they're going to pay attention to this little outline of things that you need it to do.
Absolutely, absolutely. And a good designer will pay attention to your... I mean, you've got to explain a lot about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes feel like I'm a marriage counselor.
Oh, funny.
you can tell when the marriage is in good shape or not when you're doing somebody's garden. We refer to that as the toxic work site if they're fighting.
Oh, no. That sounds unpleasant.
Yeah. So, very unpleasant.
So if you're hiring somebody, I guess one of the first things you would want, one of the things you'd need to pay attention to is, are they listening to me? Do they, in fact, care? What I'm saying.
Not just going to, or that they are looking at the site with fresh eyes and saying, gee, you know, that's a great idea, but it's not going to work here.
Mm-hmm.
You have no sunlight. I get a lot of people who want to grow vegetable gardens these days.
Of course.
And they're standing in the middle of a really shady woodland garden. And you say, well, you can't really grow a lot of vegetables in this place.
Lettuce.
And they get very angry with you. Mm-hmm. So you've got to know what your site is going to do. And a professional can bring that out, who can say, look, this place is just so shady. It's so full of root systems and competing with each other. Maybe if you took some of the trees out of here, it might improve things. I mean, that sort of thing. And you would go, oh, I couldn't possibly touch a tree. They're sacrosanct. Well, actually, they're not.
And in fact, what I've realized in the course of actually interviewing people and talking about my spruce-filled front yard, it's not the best for plant diversity to have five spruce in a tiny front yard. Nothing else grows.
Nothing else will grow. And you've got highly acidic soil. Would you ever consider taking out a... four of them?
Well,
three of
actually,
them?
Four, two? No, because I've also learned that if I take four out of a clump, the last one will be much more likely to fall in a storm because the root systems that help it stay vertical have also been removed. But a couple, yeah, I'm just hoping that, you know, the pine beetle comes in and does its work on a couple.
Eventually they will. They're heading your way.
Oh, they're here. They're here.
They're here.
Yeah,
okay.
It's improving a bit.
We're beset by the ash borer in my area.
Uh-huh.
And next door is one of the ugliest looking ash trees I've ever seen in my life.
You have your fingers crossed.
And I can't wait for the ash borer to get it.
Yeah. So other things to think about when you're hiring somebody. First of all, you know, are they good? Secondly, do they listen? Do they look at the site and do they know what's appropriate? But you've mentioned, for instance, how important organic gardening is, how important it is to be using native plants. Now, if I am a complete novice, I'm not going to know whether the things that they're recommending are natives or not.
Well, that's what you say. You would say to your designer, you say, look, these things are important to me. I want to be an organic gardener. I want to use as many native plants as possible, although this is not a hard and fast rule. I like mixing native with cultivars.
Mm-hmm.
I find that it works out very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing to be most wary of is the landscaper scam. I mean, there are so many landscapers in the business who don't know what they're doing, and it's an option that didn't require very much thought, they think. And or they've always been mowing lawns, or they've always been using their leaf blowers and throwing stuff around on the ground and calling it fertilizer. Whether it's fertilizer or not is another thing. So I mean, you've got to watch what their technique is. If you see somebody coming into your neighbors' gardens, just see if they're any good. I mean, if they're bringing in a lot of chemicals, you don't want to have that anything to do with them. If they're bringing in peat moss, I can't believe this one, and saying that it's a fertilizer. I went into a garden the other day, and the entire lawn was covered with peat moss. And I said, well, what is this about? She said, oh, the gardener's just fertilizing the lawn.
Oh, my gosh.
No, he isn't. He's killing the lawn.
It was the grass was covered?
On the lawn, yeah. And I said, well, it's sterile for one thing. It's going to suck all of the moisture out of the lawn. And you don't have to worry about seeds growing because they aren't going to last. I mean, it was just that in this day and age, a gardener doesn't know that. But a lot of these guys, and they are guys, have been doing the same old forever. And it's really hard. They get very angry with me because I want to change things.
Yeah. So peat moss, just for one second here, it's not a fertilizer, right? It's,
no.
And it has no nutrients. It's very good for holding moisture.
Sarah.
And for leavening soil to some extent. But
there are better things to use. You can use coir products, which are made with coconut.
Oh, I'm so glad you know about those. Yes, that's what I use.
And I think it's a better product, and it's not going to endanger a habitat. I mean, peat bogs are extremely fragile habitat, and sending in heavy machinery in there to pull this stuff out, so that we can have peat bags, bales of peat moss, I think is immoral.
Yeah. I'm with you on that one. And I've been using coir exclusively for years now. And
yeah. It's
not as acidic as peat moss, if you're trying to acidify soil.
Well, you see, I think if you haven't got really, really acid soil, learn to live with what you've got. All of this business about changing the pH, it takes years to change pH. I mean, it's, people have to look at nature more in the way nature is actually presenting itself, rather than, I want this, and this, you know, the totally controlling hand is not a good idea. I mean, you work with what you've got.
Mm-hmm.
The light you've got, soil you've got, whether it's acid or alkaline, and choose things sensibly. I mean, this is all thrifty gardening kind of stuff, and it's all common sense. But a lot of people just don't want to pay attention to that. I just came from a garden 10 minutes ago where the gardener had put in all these rhododendrons, and they're right up against the house, which is going to be an alkaline atmosphere anyhow, because it, too often, and you know, we use the area around the house for the garbage dump from building houses, so this tends to be more alkaline alkalinity in the soil. Anyway, but there's a beautiful cherry tree, and it's just killing the poor old rhododendron. So I said, well, why don't you just get rid of the rhododendron? And it was the anger time.
Yeah, the rhododendrons need acidic soil.
They need acidic soil. They need some light. They don't need to have be up against the wall of a building.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really bad. And a lot of designers and a lot of landscapers haven't a flaming clue about plants. And it really, really irritates me.
So, again, if you get somebody who says, well, I always put in and names five things.
Yep. And then you know you've got somebody who has a dead brain garden wise.
Find somebody else.
I mean, garden blind. I mean, they're in our area, there are the five plants are, you know, and you look at them and every single garden on the street looks exactly the same. There'll be hydrangeas. Two grasses and a lot of pachysandra. I mean, it's a boring, institutional, awful look.
All right. So beware. Be careful about whom you hire. Now,
yeah.
Whether you're doing...
Have a look at some of the gardens that they've done. And if you notice that the same planting scheme, the same color scheme, the same... is, you know, somebody who just cookie cutters it out, because it's hard to make a living being a designer, and don't be fooled by a cheap price, because I've seen this happen where people quote really low prices, and then you get not a very good quality of soil, a not very good quality of this, a not good quality of that, and they just dump the trees in. They don't really fluff them out and plant them properly.
And you want your trees to do well.
Oh, yes. And we see examples of bad planting all around us. I mean, whether it's city trees that are girdled, you know, trees that have been terribly, terribly butchered by really bad pruners. So, I mean, all these things work together. If you've got a really good arborist, he can make any tree look better. If you've got a bonsai pruner brain, so that you can take your secateurs and sculpt a not very good looking shrub into something really beautiful. These are all worthwhile things to acquire, either skills yourself or the knowledge of getting in a good certified arborist. I think they're worth every penny you pay them.
Well, suppose I am working primarily on my own, and I have such a limited budget that the idea of hiring somebody simply, you know, makes my brain freak out completely. If I'm going to be bringing in a limited amount of soil, would it make sense then to start with the garden beds?
Well, and even you might want to even think about having a raised bed. If there's a way you can raise it, so you've got it in your control completely. So you've got a raised bed. You know that you're putting in good soil. You put a little bit of organic matter on the top, like compost. You should, if you have a limited budget, absolutely. I mean, everybody should be composting. But, I mean, if you have a limited budget, you must compost. Because you can make all this great stuff for free. Ah. And you're doing the environment a big favor by making compost yourself.
Definitely. So I would put this one raised bed, assuming that's all I can possibly start with, in what, the most prominent part of the garden, the place I see?
Yeah, some place where you can sit near it, where you can gaze at it, where it's going to make a huge difference from your... We always move a dining room table or a table to a window so we can look outside. It's just, it's like being in a cave and you want to look outside where it's all open. Well, if you've got something lovely out there to look at, think of the pleasure it will bring you. And I'd put in one small tree and then very, very carefully place several perennials, one or two annuals for some, you know, added pop of color, and a couple of herbs, and maybe some Swiss chard. I love Swiss chard.
Especially
and
if you...
I'd put it in anything.
And if you can get it with the variegated colored stems, they're orange, they're yellow, they're white, they're red, they're pink. They really are, and they're edible. The little leaves can go in salad. The big leaves you can cook with. Oh, wonderful stuff. Yeah. I like using lettuces ornamentally, too. Lots of different colored
ones. Yeah, because they make great edgers, and you can keep cutting them back all the time.
Yep, and keep eating them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or strawberries all around the outside edge, if the birds don't get them all. Okay. Okay, that would be my first bed, and then I gradually expand. How do I move onwards?
Yeah, well, if you think of the pockets, the planting pockets, so that if you've got your first border or bed or anything like that, then you can start thinking about something to the left or the right or behind it so that it relates to the first thing in color, but contrasts with it in texture and form of plant, so that you might choose a color scheme that you want to have floating through. I happen to like purple foliage myself, and I love evergreens, so I might make that my theme, going from one border to the next, that I want to have an evergreen, I want to have something with purple foliage, I want to have some flowers with some blue and purple in them, and if you work on something as simple-minded as that, it's so sophisticated looking, when you end up with a really great look. Now, a lot of things... The big cliche of today in gardening is in garden design are doing the Pete Udolf blocks of color blocks of plants, and Pete Udolf is a genius at it, and his all look refreshing and great. And unless you're absolutely brilliant, it's a pretty dull look. And most of the people I notice who are doing this blocks of plants, you know, where you get 18 of one thing and 20 of another, and you make squares out of them or circles or something like that. It's just horrible. And it doesn't make ecological sense. And most of these people are putting plants together that won't work together. Or there's my favorite one is one that's right near me where every single plant that was put in there self-seeds. So the first year it looked not very good, and the second year it looked like a really bad haircut.
Just went nuts.
It was awful.
Yeah.
Just terrible.
Yeah.
Everything was seeding all over the joint.
Yeah, so...
And all of these things require lots of maintenance. So to me, what looks beautiful to my eye is my own garden, which has got the biodiversity. It's got all sorts of different kinds of plants in it. It attracts lots and lots of birds and insects. They all kind of get along together. The good guys beat out the bad guys most of the time. And it has an aesthetic to it, so that in my mind, I wanted to have a really lovely tapestry look, and that's what I've got, and it is so satisfying in a way that if I looked out there and they saw, you know, 12 of this and 6 of that and in some kind of a geometric pattern, I would be really bored by the second day.
Well, you've got some tips about actually going and buying plants. Can you tell us about those? I'm headed for the nursery.
You're headed for the nursery, and in my mind, I always try to have a list either a list in my head or a list in my hands, and I try to focus on that because I find nurseries unbelievably seductive. I mean,
dangerous things. They should be banned.
Dangerous. You should also, before you go to a nursery, absolutely have a budget. Do not go in there with a credit card that is open-ended. You've got to have a budget and stick to the budget. If you've only got $200 to spend, spend it really carefully and well. Or if you've got $20 to spend, do the same, you know, really carefully and well. And I've got a lot of tips in the book, Thrifty Gardening, that tell you how to propagate your plants and make more out of less. And this is very, very important if you've got a limited budget.
And
you've got to learn how to propagate.
Yeah, so you may start with one.
And you end up with several.
Right. And this is not just seeds. Sometimes with bulbs, it's more bulbs or it's separating.
Well, you can do it with perennials. If you, if you buy a perennial for $12 and whack it in half.
You've got two.
And we tell you in the book several ways to do it. I mean, you will have three or four or five plants very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are.
And don't expect, when you're going to the nursery, do not expect too much of any perennial, for instance. It takes a couple of years for a perennial to really do something. So don't expect that to happen immediately. And do expect lots to happen from annuals, and don't put them in too early in the season. If you have, say, three annuals of the same kind and you put them close together, you'll have a really good display very quickly.
So with the perennials, if you don't have much money in particular, you might be buying the smaller ones. It does take them a while to get established and to decide to make flowers, for instance. That may not happen that first year. And so you may want to reserve some of your budget for the annuals so you've got some kind of color display that first year.
Absolutely. And a number of really good ways to buy plants are to belong to a society. And they always have plant sales, and the plant sales are terrific. They're all garden-raised. You can trust the people who have been making them, and they will probably be able to give you lots of good information. So a little horticultural society can be one of the most valuable things you can do for your $15 a year.
That's another place where you might get tips about good landscapers.
Absolutely. Or especially, yeah, and you'll get tips about what you can and cannot grow in your area.
Because you'll be talking to people who are trying to do more or less the same thing you are in more or less the same place.
That's right.
Yep. Yeah. Talking to people is really important. Yeah. And again, because, as you said, they're there in your area, and even your side of town could be different from the other side of town.
Oh, gosh. Blanca Way can be completely different. Where I live, the precise spot I live is alluvial soil. And a few blocks away, it's completely different.
That's fascinating.
Because it was further out from the ancient sea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we've got some tips about designing, especially if you don't have a big budget and you're doing it yourself, start small. We've got some tips about buying the plants. Have that list. Know what you're getting. So do your planning and your research ahead of time.
Oh, yes.
Learn how to propagate so that the things you buy will go further. What else should we be paying attention to?
I think just mainly looking around us. Because if we appreciate what we see in our cityscapes, in our landscape, in the countryside around us, and really, really see it, not for, oh, it's full of weeds or it's full of stuff I don't know about, but see how nature creates beauty in it, on its own without our help, and learn from that. I mean, if we don't learn from nature, we are doomed.
That is the truth.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So looking, observing, paying attention to what we see. Yeah.
And relating to all of that, and get children and grandchildren involved if you can possibly drag them away from their computers.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, good luck is right.
I'm actually going to back up here a minute, and because you've got a section. Oh, so you have some wonderful tips about decorating the garden, and you have some absolutely hilarious examples of objects that people have brought into the garden. And this is hardscaping, and as we said before, expensive. Unless, for instance, you're using a bed frame.
Oh, listen, an old bedstead. That can make a really good background for a vine. I mean, there are lots of things you can get out of the garden. I'm a big garbage picker, and I've gotten most of my plant props from the garbage. People for a while, they were getting rid of their fireplaces and stuff like that. So I would just pick up any andiron I'd seen or anything that was metal that I could stick in the ground and prop up plants. And they're with me 20 years later.
So these andirons are what you use for plant supports.
Yep. I'm always looking in the recycling bins, and when garbage day comes around, I'm one of those.
There's Marjorie out there picking through the
peering into them, seeing what I can see. What can I recycle?
Okay, bedsteads.
How would I use that?
Fire andirons. What else?
Oh, there are all sorts of things. People throw out the most amazing things. I mean, I've picked up a child's collapsible table, for instance, which I can stick away in a corner and bring it out, and it's a great little planting, you know, just a little planting table. Junk from barns is great. Any kind of metal thing from a barn is wonderful. I've got all sorts of cogs and wheels and stuff like that I hide in the garden. You don't stick them out so that it looks like a junkyard. But you're walking along and you see this lovely Japanese maple, and underneath it is this very subtle, and it turns out to be a cog from an old machine. Well, there are two things going on there. There's the intellectual thing, is what is a machine and how does a machine relate to nature, and how does this plant relate to the shape of the cog? I mean, so lots of things are going on that way.
Wow. That's more than I feel prepared to take on. I have to say, I'm afraid I need to stick them in at random.
It's lots of fun.
But I love the bedstead as trellis, for instance, and you know, things like that. It just sounds very inventive. And
oh, grates! I mean, I got a wonderful grate from a fence, a grill from a fence, and I have had that on a fence in my garden, and I cover it with vines. And so every so often, you can see this metal in the background, and it's
yeah,
makes you curious.
Yeah, just intriguing. I like that idea. Wonderful. Mm. Well, I think we are about out of time here, but it's been a wonderful, astonishingly hour, and I want to thank you. And it seems as though a lot of this actually is about planning, a combination of thinking and being inventive.
It is, because I've always said, and I realized this right from the beginning when I started becoming a gardener, is that gardening is kind of an intellectual pursuit. You have to know something. You have to read. You have to think. And you can't just bash about and throw plants into the ground and expect something to happen. And so the longer you meditate on what nature is offering you, and the better gardener, designer, and gardener you will become.
So it's a matter largely of, as you said, observing.
Oh, yes, observing and thinking.
And seeing what nature does around you, and then recognizing what you want and learning to fit that into what nature or the previous owners to some extent have handed you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And know that you can change things, and it will take some time. People who want instant gardens are fools. Mm-hmm. We installed a garden today, and the guy said, "How come you chose such a big tree?" Because we were struggling away with this lovely tree. And I said, "I really did feel that you had to have something in your garden that was solid and large." And that's okay too. But you know, you have to know what your limits are. You know, how big a thing that your garden will take, how big a thing that you'll be able to move around yourself.
So one reason to hire somebody would be if you feel you don't have the time to do that research, to do that thinking, to learn what are the native plants that would grow in the shade, in this area, in this soil.
Yes.
And if you decide, I don't want to do this, then it might be cheaper to hire somebody.
I can't do it right now. Mm-hmm. Give me something mm-hmm. that will make me happy. Because when people have crap all around them, you know that that is a symptom of depression. And because you're depressed, you can't do anything with the landscape around you. And because you can't do anything or participate, you get depressed. So, I mean, if one thing works against the other. If you're surrounded by extraordinary beauty all the time, I defy you to be depressed all the time.
All the time, at least, yeah. It's true. I remember walking into an acquaintance's house once, and this was somebody who had told me she had problems with depression. And quite honestly, I thought, wow, if I lived in this house, I'd get depressed.
I'd be depressed.
Yeah, it was extraordinary.
I know. And gardens are the same thing. They tell you a lot about the inner life of a person.
So
it's very revealing.
Yeah, and sometimes, I mean, one of the symptoms of depression, of course, is that you can't do things. And that's when you might need to hire somebody to get the process started.
Absolutely.
So that you can climb far, you have something that's lovely to look at, and then you can perhaps begin to add to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Interesting. Thank you so much, Marjorie.
Oh, you're most welcome. This has been a pleasure talking to you, Kate.
I've been talking with gardening consultant and author Marjorie Harris about her new book, Thrifty Gardening from the Ground Up. You can find her at marjorieharris.com. You'll find her blog there and information about her upcoming garden tour of Italy. 2 weeks in Italian gardens, often with the designer of the garden as well as with Marjorie herself. That's our show for this week. Be well and garden on.
Pulling weeds, picking stones, man is made of dreams and bones. Feel the need to grow my own, cause the time is close at hand. And grain for grain, the sun and rain, find my way in nature's chain. And tune my body and my brain to the music from the land.